with our motivation. So there's many, many sentient beings in this universe, many on this planet. And in comparison to the number of sentient beings there are, the opportunity, those who have the opportunity to listen to the Dharma, are actually very few. So we have that opportunity. It's important that we make good use of it, that we not waste it in joking around, in insulting other people, in defending ourselves against this, that, and the other thing. But it's important that we really apply the Dharma to our mind and use it to change our emotions, change our attitudes, and in that way also change our behavior. And in changing our emotions and our attitudes, we also change what we consider to be important and what is the meaning and purpose and aim of our lives. So the idea of escaping from cyclic existence, being liberated from it, the ideas of being of great benefit to living beings and attaining Buddhahood to do that, all these are things that were never taught to us when we were little kids as purposes of our life or as aims to pursue. So as adults, we have to really consider them and think about them carefully. And if they seem to be valuable aims and purposes, then to engage with them and really do it wholeheartedly, not keeping Dharma as a hobby or, you know, something we do once in a while when we're bored, but something that is very meaningful in our lives. And so with that kind of motivation, let's share in the Dharma teachings this evening and then practice them and apply them to our minds so that we can actualize our long-term purposes. Okay, so the last two Fridays I was traveling, and you completed the perfection of joyous effort. So you are all now full of joyous effort in the Dharma, right? Taking delight in virtue. So the next of the perfections is meditative stability. And so we'll start that one today. Okay. So the teachings on meditative stability center around cultivating serenity mostly, and then after that talk about gaining the dhyanas, which are the form realm absorptions, and gaining the four formless realm absorptions. So all that is included in this, the perfection of meditative stability. And so concentration or samadhi is a very important part of that. And, you know, concentration, being able to focus our mind, is something that's important even in our daily life. You know, if we can't keep our mind on what we're doing and we're bouncing around and doing this and that and can't focus our mind, then we never really accomplish anything, do we? You know, because we live in a state of perpetual distraction. And nowadays, we have more distraction than ever. Yeah, because we're constantly bombarded with sense stimuli everywhere we go, you know. I mean, people don't cherish silence anymore. Every public space, there's music, there's flashing things and colors. People are glued to their screens. We have sensory overload, basically. And so the mind's constantly distracted. And I think this constant distraction makes it, you know, it's harder to concentrate because we can't focus on one thing. And our mind somehow seems bored when it has to focus on one thing, you know, because we're used to this excitement and, you know, the next scene, you know, is coming right away and we're waiting for it to happen. Okay. Having said that, you know, it is important to distinguish between concentration in our daily activities and meditative concentration. So concentration in our daily activities is very important, but it's not the same kind of concentration you use in meditation. Because in meditation, when we're talking about serenity or the dhyanas or meditative absorptions, we're talking about single-pointed concentration, where the mind, the mental consciousness, holds an object single-pointedly without it going to another object. So, sure, when you go to school, you need to be able to concentrate on your studies, but what you're studying, what you're reading is constantly changing. Okay, if you're painting or you're playing music or you're doing sports, you need to be able to concentrate on what you're doing, but that isn't meditative concentration because your object is changing. When you're playing music, there's different notes. When you're doing art, you're different colors, different shapes. When you're doing sports, you're moving, okay? So here, when we're talking about meditative concentration, it's really focused on one object, and it's the ability to keep the mind on that object, full serenity, for, you know, at least 4 hours, without the mind kind of getting anxious, getting dull, getting distracted, getting lax, nothing like that, but being able to be completely absorbed in that way. Okay? So, you know, I say this because sometimes people think, you know, when I'm playing golf, I have incredible concentration, or, you know, when I'm, I don't know, fixing the computer, I really have to concentrate. That's general daily life concentration, but it's not meditative concentration. Okay. So in meditation, there's kind of two processes in general. One is serenity and one is insight. So serenity, that's shamatha, or sometimes it's translated as calm abiding. Calm abiding is a literal translation of the Tibetan, but it doesn't make much sense, does it? Those two words linked together. Serenity, I think, is a little bit better because the mind is serene and concentrated, but it also isn't exact. So, you know, it's one of these terms where we can't get it exact. And then, so serenity meditation relies predominantly on concentrative type of meditation or meditative stability and stabilizing meditation, that's the name of it, stabilizing meditation, whereas insight relies more on analytical meditation. But having the culmination of insight is actually a union of those two, Okay. So it's important to understand the importance of generating serenity, yeah, because first of all of our virtuous activities become more focused when we can meditate and keep our mind on what we're meditating. And so when we can be more focused and not so distracted, then we can understand things deeper because the mind is on the object. And then even if we switch over to analytical meditation, at least we can stay in doing that analysis. Our mind isn't bouncing around and all over the place. And then that makes the Lam Rim meditations we're doing have a stronger effect on our mind. Yeah, because when you're doing the Lam Rim meditations, you're doing analytical meditation. But you have to be able to keep your mind somewhat on the object then, not single-pointedly, but at least not distracted. And then after you come to some conclusion in your Lam Rim meditation, some experience or conclusion comes, then you want to be able to hold your mind on that so that your mind can integrate that experience. Yeah, not just for one flash of a second you feel compassion and then the next moment you're off on something else. Okay, but to really be able to hold that experience of compassion, or to hold the object of emptiness, or hold the joy in having a precious human life, something like that. So it's very helpful in those regards. We really need concentration. It's also, serenity is the foundation for generating insight. And like I said, the union of serenity and insight on emptiness in particular. Yeah, so realizing emptiness can be done with analytical meditation, but to have a direct perception, there has to be single-pointedness as well. Okay, and in addition, through concentration, we can generate all sorts of super knowledges. So these different kinds of abilities that come from concentration. And these are very important for being able to benefit sentient beings. So these are things like knowing other people's minds, knowing previous rebirths, clairaudience, being able to hear things far away, clairvoyance, being able to see things far away, and so on. Okay, and so those abilities are very important if you're following the Bodhisattva path. For hearers and solitary realizers, some of them actualize those super knowledges, some of them don't. It's not really essential for them because their aim is their own liberation, whereas these super knowledges are really important for benefiting others. Okay. Now, in addition to teaching us the benefits and importance of serenity, our teachers and the texts as well also give us some precautions to observe. And they start telling us the precautions now, even when we haven't generated serenity, just so we can have them in our mind for later when we do. So one of the precautions is to not get attached to the bliss of the concentration, because apparently it's quite blissful, and so it's easy to get attached to that. And then if you haven't generated renunciation, if you haven't realized emptiness, then you just stay with that bliss and you get stuck. And then, of course, after the karma, to be reborn in, one of the four form realms or formless realms ends, then you go kerplunk down to the desire realm. Okay. Another warning is, not just not to get attached to the bliss of serenity, but don't confuse it with liberation. because apparently there's some non-Buddhists, and it's easy for Buddhists to do as well, that when you have that kind of bliss, you think, this is the utmost bliss, and so it must be liberation. I must be liberated. Yeah, and so then there's stories of these people who think that they're liberated, and then at the time of death, the afflictions, the self-grasping comes very strong, and they realize I'm not liberated, and then they begin to have a lot of doubt and a lot of wrong views and think, I've practiced the path this long, they told me this was liberation, it's not, there's no such thing as liberation. And so then they generate these wrong views at the time of death, and that does not bode well for a good rebirth. Yeah, so to be aware of that. And so it's very important, and when we're doing serenity meditation, to maintain a very strong and clear motivation. So to be very clear that we're doing it not just for the experience of bliss, not just for the super knowledges, yeah, but and not even just for liberation, but we're doing it to attain full awakening so we can really have what's necessary to benefit sentient beings. Okay, so important to have a clear motivation and maintain that, and then to check our experiences with a qualified spiritual mentor, and to also follow the advice of our spiritual mentors. Okay, so not to go making up our own kind of meditation because it sounds good and all. But having said that, you know, within whatever technique we're taught, or, you know, there's ways in which, you know, you can adjust it to your own personality or whatever. So you don't have to, like, be rigid, but also, you know, we need to follow the instructions. Okay. His Holiness makes the comment that if you don't have concentration, then even if you recite the Heart Sutra, you know, the mantra in the Heart Sutra, Gata Gata Paragata Parasam Gata Bodhisoha, if you don't have concentration, then it's kind of what we're saying is meaningless, you know, because we can't focus on the deeper meaning. We can maybe have an intellectual understanding of it, but without concentration, we can't go into the deeper meaning of these things. Okay, so then Atisha talks about some important, the importance of, you know, of concentration. So he says, all the Buddhas say the cause of the completion of the collections, whose nature is merit and pristine wisdom, is the development of the super knowledges. That's interesting. Yeah, the super knowledges are based on concentration. Just as a bird with undeveloped wings cannot fly in the sky, those without the power of the super knowledges cannot work for the good of living beings. So even though the super knowledges are not our ultimate aim, Atisha's talking here, you know, in terms of somebody who's a bodhisattva who wants to collect, fulfill the collections of merit and wisdom. So they need these super knowledges to act out their bodhisattva, their bodhicitta, and concentration or serenity is the key to gaining those. Okay, another verse from Sutra, from Atisha. In order to develop the super knowledges and the beyond samsara paths, so those are the paths that lead to liberation or full awakening, you should first cultivate serenity. If your serenity practice is weak, you will gain no power, even through sustained efforts. Okay. Therefore, accomplish the trainings in the various levels of samadhi. Okay, so, you know, our mind is weak if we can't focus it and sustain any concentration. Okay, Shanti Deva says, Recognizing that the afflictions are eradicated by insight imbued or informed with serenity, one should first seek serenity. This is achieved with detachment towards the world and with joy. Yeah, so prior to gaining full insight, he's saying we have to gain serenity. Okay. Now, we tend to hear all this benefit of concentration, and then we say, okay, I'm going to make that my principal practice. Yeah, and I'm just going to develop concentration and, gain samadhi. And our teachers generally don't encourage that. Because what they want us to develop first is stability in the Buddhist worldview and stability in the three principal aspects of the path. Because without that, some experience of the three principal aspects of the path, we're not going to have the correct motivation for doing serenity meditation. So even if we develop single-pointedness, then we're going to wind up taking rebirth in the form realm or formless realm, which was, one of the warnings that we just had before of getting attached to the bliss and then just taking rebirth in those realms and getting stuck there and then falling down later or mistaking those realms for liberation. So our teachers don't, start us off at the beginning of the path with, let's develop concentration. And, they start us off on all sorts of other things that really, because becoming a Buddha isn't just concentration. And it isn't just, realization of emptiness. It's a lot of the path is character development. Yeah, it's developing a good character. It's learning how to be an ethical person who has a kind motivation and can cherish others more than self. Yeah, so don't just think of the path as gaining some super duper experience that's, out of this world, but it's really, becoming a healthy human being who can function in the world without harming others and with being able to benefit them. So building our character, our inner strength, our mental clarity about what to practice and abandon, our ability to restrain from non-virtue, and so forth. Okay? And in fact, when we hear about the three higher trainings as being the path to liberation, the first one is ethical conduct, the second one is concentration, the third one is wisdom. And they come in that order for purpose, because we need firm ethical conduct in order, it will make the development of concentration much, much easier. And then concentration will make the development of wisdom easier. Also, because as we'll talk when we get further into how to develop serenity, there's two mental factors. One is mindfulness and the other one is introspective awareness that are very important in the development of serenity. And they're very, very important. And you begin to develop and strengthen those two mental factors when you practice ethical conduct. If you don't practice ethical conduct, then you're starting with the high bar of mindfulness and introspective awareness. So it's better to start with the low bar and then go to the high bar. Okay. Then, to develop full serenity, so you're really going to actualize serenity, then you have to have a very conducive environment. And so in in Shravaka Bhumi, Sangha's text, the hearer's ground, he listed 13 prerequisite conditions for the development of serenity. Kamala Sila summarized these into 6. Yeah, and if any of the 6 are missing, we won't be able to attain full serenity. So when you hear the 6, you'll realize that really to attain serenity requires a retreat situation. Yeah. Now that doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to improve our concentration at all, simply because we don't have the 6 prerequisite conditions right now. You know, we definitely can practice these teachings and improve our concentration, but don't expect to gain serenity if we don't have all the conducive circumstances. Okay? So it's like, you know, you can cook something even if you don't have all the ingredients. Yeah? But it's better if you have all the ingredients. Yeah? Okay, so let's go through the 6 conditions. Okay, so the first one is living in a favorable place. So this is a place that's calm, quiet, and healthy. Okay, so it has clean water, clean air. You can attain your requisites, food, clothing, medicine, and shelter easily so that you're not disrupted by having to, you know, go down to the bazaar, you know, or into Safeway to get what you need and, you know, or go without, and, you know, being seemingly hungry or whatever. So it's also good if we can meditate in a place where great meditators meditated before, because it's like a blessed place. It's imbued with the energy of that their meditation, so that encourages us and helps us. The area should also be safe, so you know, not with lions and tigers and bears, ho-ho, that are, you know, circumambulating your hut. You know, if the bears stay away in the forest, that's okay. But, you know, you want to be in a place that's safe. And then also to be near other meditators and to be near your teacher or near other Dharma friends. So, you know, because if you live near other meditators, then, you know, it's the same as living in the monastery. Everybody's doing the same thing, so it becomes very easy to do it. Yeah. And so in Dharamsala, you know, up above Dharamsala, the other side of the valley, there's all these huts where the different meditators go. And so, you know, they're all there. They have their own hut, and they meditate separately, but they live near each other. So if somebody has difficulties in their meditation, they can go and ask, you know, questions or seek the advice of a fellow meditator. You know, if they get sick, there's somebody else around who can help. Yeah, so, you know, we get this idea, you know, I'm going out to the forest, out cave where no other sentient being is before, you know, before. That's not so smart. Yeah, it's really not so smart. You know, and if you look, the meditators, you know, all live in close proximity to other people. Yeah. To other meditators, I should say, not just anybody. Okay. In Dharamsala, it was very nice because, you know, it was usually the older monks who were living in the huts, and they had disciples, and so their disciples would do the shopping. And one of my teachers lived up in those huts, Geshe-shi Thobten, and one of his disciples who went to the dialectic school, every Sunday, I think it was, which was the day off, he would do shopping, and then he would carry the supplies up on his back to Geshe-la's hut. And I went with him once or twice. It was very, very inspiring to do that. So this disciple was really dedicated and enabled Geshe-la's retreat to to go, you know, very well. Okay, so so that's the first favorable condition. Yeah. Then the second one is before going into retreat, we should develop a clear and correct understanding of all the methods to practice to develop serenity and how to overcome the hindrances, how to overcome the faults, the interferences in practicing serenity. So we really need to study and have a very clear idea. Yeah. And what's even better is if, you know, we have a teacher who has done long retreat or has this realization who can also share some of their personal experience with us. Yeah. Many years ago, I think it must have been in the maybe around 88, 87, 88, then Alan Wallace organized for Genlam Rinpa to come to Dharma Friendship Foundation. And Genla was one of those meditators, you know, up in the mountains. And he led a retreat at Cloud Mountain, and everybody had their own room. And, you know, he gave all the teachings. And I think they did a year-long retreat, although some people were only there for 3 months. Yeah, but very good. And he wrote a book. Anybody know the name? They edited Genla's teachings into a book. I forget the name of it, but it's I highly recommend it. It's, yeah, so to have the, you know, the correct and intellectual understanding, calming the mind. Okay. And is the author listed as Genlam Rinpa? Okay. Because that, of course, wasn't his, that was his nickname. That wasn't his real name. Okay. Yeah, because he practiced the Lam Rim, so he was Lam Rinpa. Yeah, the Lam Rim person. Yeah. Then the third one. Yeah, now we're getting to things that are more difficult. We should be free from coarse desires and have few desires. Okay, so we may live in a cave. We may live in some kuti or hut somewhere. But if we crave a soft bed, delicious food, a companion, music, a good sci-fi book, you know, our mind's going to be constantly distracted. So here you see why doing the preliminary training before going into retreat is so important. Because if you don't have a mind that has few desires, then you're going to sit there on your cushion and you might sit up straight and everything, but your mind is, you know, it's going through all the advertisements, it's going through, you know, everything you want, everything you should have had. I mean, it all comes up and it's just one big, big, big distraction. I had a friend who was going to do a retreat. She got all the perfect conditions, built a house, good neighbors nearby, everything. And then, I'm not sure, I think she had to renew her visa, which I think worked out okay for her. But then other people were having visa problems, so she decided to help all of them with their visa problems. Goodbye retreat. Yeah. So, you know, and this was her own doing, basically, you know, kind of wanting to be active, wanting to do something. It's hard to be alone all the time. And it's hard to really strengthen your mind to do concentration meditation like this. Okay. So she found another activity to do. Yeah, so, you know, this is why, I mean, that wasn't a desire like craving music or craving chocolate cake, but it was, you know, maybe craving company. Yeah, craving a project, craving something to do, okay? So, You know, when you do long retreat, it's like there's always things that happen, and you know, you may make your cave of the renunciate as comfortable as you want, you know, with central heating and you know, and arrange for your attendant to bring you 3-course meals and, you know, have everything, you know, just exactly the way you want it. But samsara being the way it is, something's going to go wrong. And, you know, your light, your electricity is going to go out, or, you know, your meditation cushion is going to get filled with mice, or something's going to happen. So, you know, you really have to have some level of determination to be free of samsara and some level of, you know, reduced desire and craving in order to keep on, you know. Otherwise, you throw a fit and, you know, oh, there's a mouse in my meditation cushion, you know, get it out. I need a new meditation cushion, quick. Yeah. Or, you know, something happened. Oh, there's mold. All my cheese has mold on it. You know, I can't eat my cheese. I'm going to starve during the retreat. Even though you have a whole, you know, pantry full of stuff. I'm going to starve, you know, because there's mold on my cheese. I can't eat cheese. I don't have enough protein. I'm going to die, you know. So, you know, when your mind's like that, how, you can't concentrate, can you? Yeah, so this is why we need some desire, you know, freedom from gross desires beforehand. The fourth is we must be satisfied and content, not wanting more and better. Okay, so this kind of contentment is very rare in modern society. Because they're always telling us we need something new and better. Even if you go and you're going to do your retreat and you're going to write up all your Dharma notes, okay, during your retreat, during the break time, yeah, sounds good. And then your computer breaks or you hear there's a new kind of computer. Yeah, because you have Wi-Fi in your cave. Yeah, why not? I mean, in India, they have these big, what do you call it? The you know, not the dishes, but the
towers.
The towers, yeah. And, you know, so you can get Wi-Fi. And there's a new kind of computer that will make writing out all my notes on serenity so much easier, or keeping my journal on my meditation easier. I want that new computer. Okay, so you know, being able to sit in meditation without all of this going on in our mind, you know, is going to be much easier if now, when we're living our regular life, we practice contentment and having fewer desires. Yeah, so it's a. You know, and you can start doing that even with your food now. Try not adding any condiments and learning to be happy with whatever you eat, even if it doesn't have enough salt or enough sugar, or if it's too this or it's too that. Can you endure it? Or are you going to try it for one day and then get your bottle of tamari sauce and your bottle of chili sauce and, you know, your sugar and your, you know, all your other things and make sure that you have everything you like? Huh? Okay. Or try when we do group retreat. You know, remember I was telling the story before how one person gets up in the middle and opens the window and the next person 15 minutes later goes and closes the window. And yeah, so try being the person who does not open or close the window, who just deals with whatever the temperature is. It's too hot, it's too cold, you deal with it. Yeah? Try that. Huh? And see if you can make your mind happy. Okay? Okay, so that's the satisfaction and contentment is the fourth one. Then fifth one, we must be free of involvement in worldly activities and commotion. So this was the one that my friend got distracted with the visas, you know, just kind of being everybody's visa expert. So if we're involved in many projects, we write letters, we write emails, we read other unrelated books, we have to take care of our family, or we get involved in family dramas, then many distractions are going to take us right away from our meditation. Okay? So they may take us physically out of retreat. Yeah, because somebody in the family is ill and I'm the only one who can take care of that family member. So goodbye retreat. You go and take care of your family member who has the flu. You know, somebody else maybe could take care of that family member. They may be able to recover on their own, but you feel I'm the only one who can do it. Yeah. And it seems like compassion, but it's goodbye retreat. Yeah. So this is one of the reasons why, you know, when you come here to the Abbey, we have, you know, guidelines about not going for the guests, not going online more than every 10 days, because then all of a sudden, you know, you're writing to this friend and writing to that friend and checking this and checking that, and your mind is no longer here. Your body's here. Your mind is with all your friends and, you know, well, I'm just checking my email for one thing. But, well, as long as I'm on email, I'll see what other things came in. And, this and this is going on. Maybe I should read the news article about it. Or, maybe I should check my friend's Facebook page. Or, and then, gone. Okay? Body here, mind somewhere else. Okay, and then also, what's easy to happen when you're here is you're planning the next place you're going to go. Yeah, you want to go online and do a Google for Buddhist monasteries in the U.S. so that you can plan where you're going to go after you're here and what dates they have courses and retreats, and send in your application, and then you have to, you know, buy your air ticket or bus ticket or whatever. And then again, you know, body's here, mind is somewhere else. So if we can't do that here, just in, you know, when we have plenty to distract us already when we're here, how are we ever going to do that on retreat? Yeah, because, you know, you go on retreat, like, and then you want to keep up a log. Yeah? Yeah, we had somebody who was here who was, he wanted to become a wandering monk, wandering in the forest, and just, you know, meditate in the forest and wander place to place here in America. So he went off to do that. And the day he was leaving, you know, another monk suggested that he keep a blog of, you know, what he's doing as a wandering monk. And so that's what he did. So forget meditating in the forest, you know. He was keeping a blog, you know. And so that friend who told him to do that wasn't a real friend. That's an example of a bad friend. Because a real friend would not encourage you to write a blog when you're going to do like a retreat or a wandering retreat or something like that. Okay? But, you know, then we fall for it, don't we? It's like, I can write a blog. Then, and then, you know, pictures. I want to have pictures on it and what I'm doing. And, you know, those days there wasn't Instagram. Now there's Instagram. So, you know, imagine what it would be like, you know? And then, of course, you sit down to meditate and you think of all these great writing ideas, You know, I want to write a book about this. I want to write a book about that. I want to do a photo album. And you think of all these ways to spread the Dharma. You know, when I get out of retreat, I'm going to organize a panel discussion on this. And then I'm going to go and I want this person to meet that person because that will revolutionize the whole field of chemistry forever. And, you know, and you're planning all this stuff. Yeah? And, you know, those people, any of you like planning things? Yeah? Yeah? So, yeah, so then you have everything planned out. Yeah, no retreat being done. Yeah. And then the sixth, so that's the fifth one, free from involvement of worldly activities. And then the sixth is living in pure ethical conduct. So whatever precepts and commitments that we have accepted, that we've taken on, then we should keep those. And at the very least, we should abandon the 10 destructive action paths of action, okay? Because if we aren't able to control our coarse activities of body and speech, how are we going to control the mind, which is what developing concentration is about? Yeah, so that's why another reason why ethical conduct comes before concentration, yeah, because it's so much easier to control physical and verbal actions than mental actions, because physical and verbal, for the body and mouth to move, the mind has to move, so there's some delayed, another step is needed there, some delayed response. Whereas to control the mind, you know, that thought comes in your mind and you're off and running. So to be able to control the mind like that, we have to, you know, having good ethical conduct is a very good prerequisite and foundation for doing that. And then also you don't have so many distractions because getting involved in all sorts of destructive actions is a huge distraction, and then of course you feel bad about it afterwards, and so then you have your mind's very restless and you feel remorse and, you know, more distraction. Okay, so then we're going to go into some more things here. So we're going to, as we go on, the five faults and eight antidotes. They're from Maitreya's distinguishing the middle and the extremes, and the nine stages of sustained attention and the six powers are from Asanga's hearer's grounds or Shravaka Bhumi, and the as well as the compendium of knowledge, and Maitreya's ornament. And Kamala Sila's three stages of meditation. Okay, so, and then the Sutra Unraveling Thought also has instructions on how to practice serenity. So those are the scriptural sources. Okay, so it's very important if you do when you cultivate serenity, that you don't have grandiose expectations of, you know, I'm gonna get serenity really quickly and have all these abilities and maybe I'll be famous too. Okay, but again, just to, you know, do the practice. Okay, then your physical, posture is also very important. So these are the 8 points of, or 7 points sometimes they say, of Vairochana. Yeah, so sitting cross-legged, not just regular cross-legged, but the Vajra position, left foot on the right thigh, right foot on the left thigh. That's the optimum. If you can't do that, then do half Vajra, which is putting your right foot down. If you can't do that, then also put your left foot down, and then it's kind of like Tara's position, you know. And then if you can't do that, sit cross-legged And if you can't do that, then sit on a bench. And if you can't do that, sit on a chair. Okay? Okay, so that's for your legs. Then your hands right on the left. Thumbs are touching to form a triangle. This is against your body, kind of, right, so the top of your thumbs are kind of right at your navel. Yeah, so your arms aren't sticking out like that. They're against your body. And yeah, like that. And then there's space, so that very naturally there's space between the side of your body and your arm. So your arms aren't sticking out like chicken wings, but they aren't squished either, okay? The eyes downward, if you keep them a little bit of opened so that some light comes in, then that prevents distraction. But you don't tuck your head downward. So your head is too down. Yeah, the head should be level or just slightly tuck in the chin. Yeah, but you don't want your head going down because it will keep going that way. Okay. Yeah, and then, to breathe through your nose if you can. If you can't, it's a problem. I know from having allergies and how distracting that could be. And then, of course, you want to make sure that you start your sessions with taking refuge, generating bodhicitta. It's good to offer the seven-limb practice, seven-limb prayer, and to request our spiritual mentors for inspiration also at the beginning of a session. Okay, now, there's a whole subject about, or a whole thing here about, I don't have the Sanskrit word, about the observed objects. Okay, so what your focal object, what object you're going to meditate on to develop serenity. Okay, so in one way you can say any object can be used to cultivate serenity, even a twig or a candle or whatever. Yeah, but if you use an external object like that, the external object isn't actually your object of meditation. It's the visualized image of that. Yeah, so just sitting there and staring at a candle, you're not going to develop serenity. Because serenity is developed by the mental consciousness, not by the eye consciousness. Okay? So it could happen that if, let's say, you're using the visualized image of the Buddha, or in the Theravada tradition, the Pali tradition, they use the kasinas, so they may use certain colors, kind of circles of certain colors. So you look at that. But then you lower your eyes and you have a mental image, and it's the mental image that is your object of meditation. Okay. Yeah. So we all grew up with movies of people staring at candles, didn't we? Yeah. Or hearing friends, where we all got. Didn't you ever do that with your friends? Get together and we all stare at a candle. Yeah. Yeah, after we did something else, right? Okay. Okay, so we may gain familiarity with the observed object through our visual consciousness or whatever. Or if we do it with mantra by the auditory consciousness, but it's the conceptual appearance is the actual object that we develop our serenity on. Okay. So then the Buddha spoke of four basic categories of observed objects for serenity. So they're extensive objects. Objects for purifying behavior, objects of skillful observation and objects for purifying afflictions. Okay, so I'll just go quickly through these, and then there's some other possible objects to develop serenity on. So the first one is extensive objects. So these are four types. The first one is analytical images. So that's those are the ones used in the process of developing insight. Non-analytical images are those observed by serenity without doing any analysis. The limits of phenomena is the third. So that means like phenomena can either be permanent or impermanent. That's the limit of what phenomena can be. The five aggregates are the five aggregates. That's the limit of what impermanent phenomena can be. And then the fourth one is the purpose that we seek to accomplish. So that is referring to the fruit of our concentration. Yeah. Yeah, some of these objects, it's not totally clear how you would develop some, you know, serenity on some of these objects. But anyway, they are listed. Okay, then, so those are the extensive objects. Then the objects for purifying behavior. So these are suitable for the temperament of different individuals. And they serve the purpose not only of developing concentration, but of helping us overcome certain disturbing emotions. Yeah. Because, over our previous lives, we have a lot of habit, we have certain strong emotions, and then these objects are the ones that will help us counteract those particular defiled states of mind. So someone who suffers from great desire and craving, yeah, what they meditate on is the ugly aspect of the person or the thing that they're attached to. So, meditating on the body to counteract sexual desire is an example of this. Yeah, so then your object is that it might be, the insides of a body. They might be, your object may be corpses or whatever, or bones. There's a beautiful one on bones, that is very helpful. And so that's your object. And by focusing on that object, it really helps you overcome craving and attachment because you see the object for what it really is. Okay? Somebody who has a lot of animosity, resentment, anger, they're always getting irritated, annoyed, exploding, then they should meditate on love. So especially doing the four immeasurables, love, immeasurable love, that would be their object to meditation. So that helps them develop concentration, but it also, when you meditate on love and you can focus on it single-pointedly, your anger and belligerence and that stuff goes down because you're retraining your mind. Yeah. Then somebody who suffers from confusion meditates on the 12 links. Yeah, and the dependent arising process by which we get reborn in samsara. That will reduce your confusion. It will also make you humble. Because it's not so easy to understand. Somebody who is very conceited and arrogant, they reflect on the five aggregates, the 12 sources, the 18 constituents. Focusing on all these different qualities, these different categories of phenomena, it functions in two ways. One is they're not always so easy to understand, so it lessens your arrogance. And two, and very importantly here, is the five aggregates, the 12 sources, the 18 constituents, all describe the parts of a person, a human being. And so when we meditate on these, then instead of seeing ourselves as one concrete human being, we see actually there's just a collection of different parts. So that reduces the conceit, especially the conceit of I am. Okay. And then somebody with many distracting thoughts and discursive, you know, stories going on in their mind, then they meditate on the breath, because that helps to just calm the mind and, you know, from all those distracting and discursive thoughts. Okay. So also somebody who suffers from jealousy, they would meditate on rejoicing at the good qualities of others and others' virtues and so on. Okay, objects of skillful observation. Yeah, so becoming skilled or knowledgeable in these objects is an aid to realizing emptiness. So the first one is the five aggregates, because we understand that. We'll know that the I and mine don't exist separate from the five aggregates. Being knowledgeable about the 18 constituents, then we'll understand how these 18 arise dependent on their own causes and conditions. I'm not going to go into what all these categories are right now, because it'll take us way off base. You can look them up. They're in Meditation on Emptiness. Being skilled in the 12 sources. So this helps us understand the different causes for the arising of consciousness. You know, the object, the dominant condition or the sense power, and then the immediately preceding consciousness. Being knowledgeable in the 12 links entails realizing impermanence and the nature of dukkha of all phenomena and selflessness, or what they often call the three characteristics. And then knowing appropriate and inappropriate results, it leads us to understand karma very well, because it's appropriate that happiness arises from virtue, and inappropriate that suffering arises from virtue. Okay, so those are the objects of skillful observation. Then the objects for purifying afflictions. Okay. So these help us to purify the coarse and subtle afflictions of the desire, form, and formless realms. And so here, what we're not purifying the afflictions in terms of cutting them off from the root, but we're learning how to temporarily suppress them in order to attain the next highest state, you know, to attain serenity, to attain the first dhyana, the second dhyana, third, fourth, and on up. Okay? Then, also, some people prefer to generate serenity during tantric practice. So that's fine as well. Some people say good to, some masters say good to, you know, do it on according to the Sutrayana path, you know, first, because then it just encourages you in your renunciation and bodhicitta and correct view, which is helpful for your tantric practice. But if you do it in tantric practice, that's fine. If you do it on the lower tantras, then you do it during the phase of the yoga with signs. If you do it during highest class tantra, then you're doing it during the generation stage. And so here you may meditate on having dissolved your own aggregates into emptiness, and your wisdom realizing emptiness appearing as the deity, Ah, so yourself as the deity could be your object of meditation, or seed syllables at different places in the deity's body could also be your object of meditation. Okay, then there's, so I think we'll pause here. There's some other objects that can be our observed objects, but those I want to explain a little bit more, like the conventional nature of the mind and the image of the Buddha and so on. Okay, so questions so far. Yeah.
It says inhalation and exhalation. It's talking about breathing meditation.
Yeah.
So how is that a conceptual appearance?
How is?
How would that object be a conceptual appearance, or is that an exception?
Yeah. What the Theravada tradition says is you focus on the breath, and they recommend here the upper lip and the nostrils, and then at a certain point you get what's called a nimitta, which is a little glowing something, then that appears to your mental consciousness, and that becomes your object.
Yes, and when I've listened to people talk about this, the meditation on the breath and finding that and seeing the nimitta, they say that at some point it stops being the meditating on the sensation of breathing, and it becomes the object, a mental object of the breathing. But anyway, those are the descriptions.
That the cessation of breathing?
No, the
nimitta becomes your object.
Yeah, but she was asking about meditating on the mental object, and what they have said is that you start with the physical experience of it, but it does at some point become a mental object, and then it becomes the
nimitta. I thought that was what I said.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. Or at least that was what I meant. If that wasn't what I said, that's what I meant.
Yeah, so...
Yeah.
How does concentration lead to the super knowledges?
Like, okay.
What's the mechanism?
Yeah, because okay, let's say you want to develop the super knowledge of seeing your previous rebirth, then you start concentrating. You know, you think of what you did yesterday and the day before and the day before. And that takes a lot of concentration to think about, you know, all these things and trying to remember what you did before. So it requires a lot of concentration to do that. And so similarly, you know, to develop the other powers, you need to be able to really focus the mind on something without... it going all over the place and without laxity, without agitation. Okay.
Specifically knowing what others are thinking, knowing others' minds.
Yeah. I don't know. But I would imagine, you know, that you would have to know your own mind very well, and then you would start trying to, you know, think or perceive what other people's minds are doing. I haven't received instructions on how, the specific instructions on how to develop the supernatural powers or super knowledges. I think because they only give those to people who are ready to develop them. You know, and it's quite, you know, explicit meditations that you do. And, you know, to learn to control your mind, and probably involving going in and out of different levels of dhyana and so forth. So,
You mentioned that for people suffering from confusion, they meditate on the 12 links and dependent arising, and that in the process of doing that, it makes you humble. So I've never connected, you know, needing to be humble with confusion.
Oh, okay. I was saying that it's not that the humility and confusion are linked, but I'm just saying for me, when I contemplate this, the 12 links, it makes me very humble. Okay. I'm not saying that there's a connection between confusion and humility. Yeah.
So did I understand it well that you would use the antidote as an object of calm abiding in that case?
Yeah, for the objects of purifying behavior.
Yeah.
Yeah, then it sounds like it's the antidote to certain afflictions. So for people who have a very strong affliction, developing serenity on the antidote to that affliction is going to be very helpful to them.
And would you keep that object? I mean, at a certain point, probably that affliction would get less. So then at a certain point, if you apply the antidote all the time, then I imagine that the affliction becomes less.
Yeah.
So then I imagine that you would take another object of calm abiding.
No. Not necessarily. No. In this one, like when if you develop, let's say, like the four immeasurables, yeah, are objects to develop calm abiding on. So if, you know, you have to do, let's say, for love, you have to do a certain bit of contemplation and analytic meditation and everything to break down your barriers to really having affection and love for sentient beings. And then you focus just on that experience of love. That's your object of meditation. And you don't switch to any other object. Yeah, your serenity is developed with that as the object. After you develop serenity, because then your mind is very flexible, very pliant, very concentrated, then you can use your concentration to meditate on many other objects. And that enables you to really know those other things very deeply.
Okay,
but here we're talking about just the process of developing serenity.
Yeah, sure. So you would use the same object all the way?
The same object. When you're developing serenity, you don't switch objects midway.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Do you happen to know if these objects here are this is, I think, from the Sanskrit tradition?
What I just went through, the extensive objects. Yeah, that's all from the Sanskrit
tradition.
So
are these, do you think, the same as the 40 objects described? A lot of overlap, do you happen to know?
Some are and some aren't. What's interesting is, you know, the Sanskrit tradition doesn't list, let's say, the 10 kasinas that are very popular in the Pali tradition, but the 10 kasinas are found in the Sanskrit tradition. But so I don't understand why they don't put them here, because they do mention them. I'm not quite sure. They must be mentioned in this context. So I'm not sure why they aren't here. Yeah? This is a question I have for Geshe-la. Okay. And then the Sanskrit tradition also, you know, those ones that I just mentioned, not all of those are found in the Pali tradition, too. So there's some overlap and some differences.
If you only pick one object to develop serenity with, it would seem like you should be pretty careful which one you pick for yourself, or you should have a teacher pick for you, because you want something that enhances your particular mind, rather than aggravates or exasperates.
Yeah, that's why you don't use Rambo, you know, or you don't use the person you're sexually attracted to develop. You already have somebody on that person's body. You don't use, okay? Yeah, so.
Someone online is asking, is it wrong to want to practice meditation sometimes to just calm the mind, with that being the main purpose for doing the meditation?
Yeah, it's fine. You mean just to do a meditation to calm your mind? Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, no problem. If you have a calmer mind, you'll probably create less negative karma. Okay? So is the person just asking to have, with that motivation, to calm your mind? Yeah. So, start out with that motivation, but also start to expand the motivation and think, well, it's not just so I'll feel good having a calm mind, but if I have a calm mind, I'll keep better ethical conduct. I won't harm as many people, you know? And so that I want to calm my mind so that I can, you know, be a kinder person. So, you know, you can build on that, not just so that I feel good by calming my mind. Okay. Yeah, because actually for it to be Buddhist meditation, we have to do the meditation with refuge in the three jewels. So if we just have the motivation to calm our mind, we'll calm our mind, but we wouldn't necessarily say we're doing Buddhist meditation. Yeah, because we don't have a Buddhist motivation, we don't have refuge.
If you feel pulled towards a specific object, towards developing calm abiding, should you follow it tentatively, or should you check with a teacher?
Check with a teacher. Always check with a teacher. Yeah. Yeah. Because like I said, you know, our mind, you know, I want to focus on something I find really attractive. And, you know, Marilyn Monroe or, you know, Rambo or, you know, that's not going to be helpful for you. And if you have a good teacher, they'll tell you so.
So when we do meditations around here, we are doing different sadhanas and stuff, and so the different deities become the objects of our meditation. Yeah. So I guess it's all right to be changing the object like that when we're not necessarily in a retreat for serenity meditation?
Yeah. If you're doing a retreat, then you're going to stick with one deity and develop, you know, serenity on that deity. But you still do, you may have commitments to do other daily deity practices. So you do those, but you do them quickly. Okay? So it's always better to stick with one object instead of, you know, every time, you know, so if you're doing several deity practices, pick one of them and focus more on doing that one and do the other ones more quickly. So when you're focused, the one you're doing, you know, just in terms of daily practice, then you may use that as your object for serenity. You may use that sadhana where you really explore emptiness. Okay? If you try and do all your daily practices equally with equal time on every one of them, yeah, and you want to do every single set, part of every single sadhana with full attention, you're not going to be able to do anything else during the day. Yeah. So, yeah, that's one reason why I don't encourage people to get a lot of commitments. And then if you do, what my teachers have said is you put more energy on one and do the others more quickly.
But when I'm not in retreat, trying to focus on serenity, is it? It's all right. Like usual object of meditation is an image of the Buddha.
Yeah.
But sometimes I need to use my breath to calm my mind.
Yes, and so often they say in the Tibetan tradition, they usually recommend starting with breathing meditation for 5 minutes or whatever to calm your mind. And then go into your object for developing serenity. Yeah.